Years ago, there was a story told of a farmer who desired to become rich. And he knew farming would never make him rich, so he decided he would hunt for diamonds so he could have the wealth he desired. The farmer then sold his land. He began traveling far and wide in search of areas that would have undiscovered diamonds in them. But after decades of fruitless searching, having exhausted all of his money, being despondent at his failure, the former farmer then simply drowned himself in despair. Meanwhile, the new owner of the farm had come across some strange-looking stones in the fields as he plowed them, and he thought them odd enough that he kept one of them on his fireplace mantle. A friend visited the farm one day and in his house saw this stone on the mantle, and he asked the farmer, "Do you know what this is?" The farmer replied, "No. What is it?" The friend recognized the stone for what it was. It was a huge, uncut diamond. As you can imagine, the farmer was encouraged to collect these stones and to sell them, which he did, becoming fabulously wealthy. The original farmer never bothered to look on his own land for the wealth that he was seeking. Now, who wouldn't want to find a vein of diamonds on their property? Or, depending on where you live in the world, maybe oil, gas, maybe gold, silver, or some other precious resource. It's a natural human tendency to look for something better in life, isn't it? To dream of those greener pastures, to think that if we just had X more, we would have everything we needed. So we seek to become healthier, more attractive, wealthier, more well-known, more influential, more talented, smarter, and the list goes on. But if we're not careful, we can think the grass is greener somewhere else and miss the things of value in the life that are right in front of us. We can fall into this trap even in God's church. We can seek to have recognition or to be ordained or to be seen as the most knowledgeable on a topic, or again, the list can go on. But again, if we're not careful, if we pursue those things on that level, for the sake of having something better, we think, we can oftentimes miss something of greater value right in front of us. What is the most valuable thing we could have in this life? Well, we're going to answer that question today. And in telling the story of the farmer's field of diamonds, that story came from a man named Russell Herman Conwell. Just out of curiosity, does anybody know who that is? Russell Herman Conwell. Well, Mr. Conwell was a motivational speaker. He's probably one of the first to fall under that title. He started speaking publicly in the late 1800s, early 1900s. He didn't set out to be a motivational speaker. He started out his career as a lawyer, and then he became a minister, and then a motivational speaker, and then the founder and president of Temple University in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. What's interesting is that he became a motivational speaker because he was going around trying to raise money to establish Temple University. He didn't have the money, so he decided to raise it himself. And so he would go around, give various speeches, and this speech that I gave you was just a part of one that he would give called A Field of Diamonds. He wanted to create Temple University to provide higher education to those who could not afford to go to other universities. And so he primarily wanted to create Temple University to prepare young men to be in the ministry. And that was a passion of his, as that was part of his life. He did so because he saw already at that point, in the late 1800s, that Harvard and Yale had long ago abandoned their charter in doing the same. Many don't realize that Harvard and Yale started out as colleges to train ministers. Mr. Conwell then made his mark on the speaking circuit through just the sheer volume of speaking. But he became noted for that speech that I recounted to you in my introduction. And again, we need to be careful that we're not like that farmer and miss the opportunities that are in front of us that God provides. I have no way of knowing for sure, but when I came across this some years ago, it struck me that I had to wonder if he didn't, Mr. Conwell, if he didn't use as a primary source the parable of the sower which is an interesting parable itself. Let's turn to that in Matthew 13. The parallel accounts are in Mark 4 and Luke 8, but Matthew 13, and we'll begin in the beginning of the chapter, verse 1. Matthew 13, verse 1, and it says, "On the same day Jesus went out of the house, he sat by the sea, and a great multitude were gathered together to him. So that he got out in a boat and sat, and the whole multitude stood on the shore." This is almost like a natural amphitheater. If you've ever been on a lake, it's actually fairly easy to hear someone that's far out because of the way the sound will travel across the water. And so he's out there, and he begins to speak, verse 3, and he says, "Behold, a sower went out to sow, and as he sowed, some of the seed fell by the wayside, and the birds came and devoured them. Some fell on stony places, where they did not have much dirt, and they immediately sprang up, but because they had no depth of earth, when the sun was up, they were scorched. Because they had not root, they withered away." So verse 7, "Some fell among thorns, and the thorns sprang up and choked them out, but others fell on good ground and yielded a crop, some 100-fold, some 60, some 30. He who has an ear, let him hear." This is an interesting parable, and there's much commentary if you want to go look up various things, but we're going to just ask a couple of simple questions here to begin with. What is the seed in the parable here? We're reading about this man that went out to sow in the field, but what is he sowing? What is the seed? Well, let's take a look at a few things. Psalm 33. Psalm 33 and in verse 4. We'll touch on a couple of verses here to answer that question. Psalm 33 and verse 4 simply says, "For the word of the Eternal is right, and all of his work is done in truth." It parallels in my mind into the question of what is the work. That's a discussion for another time in depth, but nonetheless we read here, "The word of the Lord is right, and all of his work is done in truth." Okay, so we're building a thought here. Let's go next to John 17. John 17 is actually part of the prayer that Christ was giving to the Father the night before his crucifixion. And he simply says here in John 17, 17, "Sanctify them by your truth. Your word is truth." Speaking of the disciples that he had even then, but even more importantly, the disciples that would come down through time. Let's go next to 1 Timothy 3. The question is, what is the seed in the parable of the sower? 1 Timothy 3 and in verse 15. We read here, it says, in that Paul talking to Timothy, "And that from childhood you have known the Holy Scriptures, which are able to make you wise for salvation through faith, which is in Christ Jesus." He goes on to talk about it being under inspiration of God for correction and so forth. In verse 17, "that the man of God may be complete." So the seed is God's truth. What's being taught in various venues, what God is offering. We'll come back to some of those thoughts as we progress here. But if we go back to the parable of the sower, if the seed is the truth of God, what is the field? Well, we're dealing in symbology here. Let's go back to 1 Corinthians chapter 3. The seed, again, is God's truth. What's the field? It has to be sown somewhere. So in 1 Corinthians 3 and in verse 9, we read here, it says, "For we are God's fellow workers, and you are God's field. You are God's building." We can say appropriately that we are God's work, but it comes down to God's truth being sown in us and that it bears fruit through us. Let's go to verse 7 here, 1 Corinthians 3, verse 7. He says, "So then neither he who plants is anything, nor he who waters, but God who gives the increase. no matter where we find ourselves. Now, the interesting thing in a modern context, this is probably not a modern phenomenon, but we tend to be fixated on money and wealth, don't we, as humans? There's always more we want. We always want more. We always want better. And so at some level, we're never satisfied. That's not necessarily wrong of itself, but yet on the other hand, we need to be satisfied with what we have, don't we? Because if we're not, we can pursue wrong things. It also negates what God is doing with us. Because if we truly believe 1 Corinthians 3, verse 7, then it's what God gives us that we should be satisfied with. But it goes back to the parable, doesn't it? God wants increase. He's not opposed to increase. It just has to be according to what he understands is appropriate, what we yield and what he can do through us. So let's transition here a little bit to build on this thought, but go back to Matthew 25. We have a different parable here, and this is the parable of the talents. Beginning of the chapter, he has the foolish and wise virgins. But then he moves to, in verse 14, a different parable. This is the parable of the talents, Matthew 25, verse 14. It says, "The kingdom of heaven is like a man traveling to a far country, called his own servants, and delivered his goods to them. And he gave to one 5 talents, to another he gave 2, to another 1, to each according to his own ability, and immediately went on a journey." In other words, he divided up what he had for them to manage while he was gone. He didn't ask the same thing for all of them, did he? He knew their strengths, their weaknesses, and he gave them of his wealth according to what they could do with it. So then verse 16, "He who had received 5 talents went and traded, made another 5 talents. Likewise, he who had received 2 earned 2 more, but he who had received 1 went out and dug a hole in the ground and hid the Lord's money." He was maybe fearful of losing even that little bit, but that wasn't the responsibility he was given, was it? It wasn't to protect it, it was to do something with it. So after a long time, it says, the Lord of those servants came and settled the accounts with them. So he came back, "What did you do with what I gave you?" So he had received 5 talents, came, and he had another 5 talents, saying, "Lord, you delivered to me 5. Look, I've gained 5 more beside them." Lord said to him, "Well done, good and faithful servant. You were faithful over a few things. I'll make you ruler over many things." Now that's an interesting statement, isn't it? He had the most given to him, and yet the Lord still says, "You were faithful over little things." Little in comparison to what the Lord had in total. But nonetheless, he praises him for what he did. "And he who had received the 2 talents, verse 22, came and said, 'Lord, you delivered to me the 2 talents. Look, I have gained 2 more besides them.'" So both of those men doubled what they had been given, didn't they? So in verse 23, the Lord says the same thing to him as he said to the first, "Well done, good and faithful servant. You've been faithful over a few things. I will make you ruler over many things." So then verse 24, the last one comes, the last of the servants. "He who had received 1 talent came and said, 'Lord, I knew you to be a hard man, reaping where you have not sown, gathering where you have not scattered seed.'" That's the parable of the sower, isn't it? The farmer wants an increase, doesn't he? The Lord wants an increase. This man should have understood that. So he admits in verse 25, "I was afraid, and I went and hid your talent in the ground. Look, and here you have what is yours." He thought that was sufficient. But if we have a handful of seed and we don't do anything with it, of what value is it if I just give it back? It hasn't produced anything more, has it? So the Lord answered and said to him, "You wicked and lazy servant. You knew that I reaped where I had not sown, gathered where I had not scattered seed, so you ought to have at least, if I can insert, deposited my money with the bankers. At the coming I would have received back my own with interest. Therefore take the talent from him," meaning the one that had 1, "and give it to him who had 10. To everyone who has, more will be given, to him who has, and he will be abundant. But from him who does not have, even what he has will be taken away." and cast the unprofitable servant into outer darkness. It can sound harsh, which is what the man said, right? I knew you to be a harsh master. But that's not what God is asking us. He's not asking us to do things that are hard, necessarily, that he's being unreasonable, but simply that he wants a return. God then so castigated this servant because he saw what that servant did as squandering an opportunity, even if the servant didn't think it was very much. The farmer, to go back to the story from Mr. Cromwell, didn't think he had anything to start with, did he? He didn't bother to search his own land first if he thought diamonds were where he would make his money. But even if he had opened maybe the possibility that there could be something else there. But the end of the result is that he missed the treasure right under his nose, didn't he? That was just temporary wealth. God has reserved something far greater for us. Let's continue Matthew 25 and verse 34. It says, then the king will come and say to those on his right hand, come you blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. I ask the question, what is the most valuable thing we could have in this life? And the simple answer is in this verse, that we have been given the opportunity to be in God's family, to be in his kingdom. This is a truth virtually unknown outside the church of God. Most of mankind doesn't understand the purpose of why they exist. We're a random chance of mutations, evolutionary processes that took millions of years. Well, that doesn't answer the question of why we're here, does it? Is it really just random? And if it is, what is the purpose of life then? And so we see the extension of that, and it's not a good history. The beginning of the 20th century was one of the most violent times in mankind's history. But do you realize that it came out of a couple of deeply false ideas that mankind tried to build into life? Evolution, communism, and a desire for power. Millions of people died over the course of those first 50 or so years. But we're here today, aren't we? July 4th in this country is a celebration of the founding of this nation. And it has certain unique principles on which it was founded. Many of those are falling by the wayside or being pushed aside under the name of progress for some. But I find it interesting that in the Declaration of Independence, it stated, the signers of that document said that they saw certain truths to be self-evident. They listed some of those: life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness. Okay, those are rights, but that doesn't mean we're owed them. There's a responsibility, isn't there? There's a morality behind those original thoughts. But over the centuries in this country, we've moved from that morality to hedonism. We just simply seek pleasure. Let's go to Psalm 27. Have you ever considered that this country has succeeded for more than 200 years under those principles espoused in the Declaration of Independence? Now, there are some that will say, well, it needs to be a living document, which in their mind means it should be open to change and interpretation based on what they see as valuable and so forth. And that's a different conversation or argument for a different time. But there is no argument, really, that this nation is unique in mankind's history. And if you're honest about it, you can see that God directed it to be so, for a very specific purpose. But in Psalm 27 and verse 4, we read this: one thing I have desired of the Eternal that I will seek, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life. Do we truly, truly seek that? We can easily get distracted, can't we, in life? It was mentioned in the sermonette. Trials and difficulties and challenges come along the way. And it's so easy to get discouraged or to lose sight of the vision that we should have, the purpose that we're striving for. And the psalmist here, David, acknowledges this. He says, all the days of my life to behold the beauty of the Lord, to inquire in his temple, to be with God. For many, if they still believe in God, that sounds almost too fantastic. God is over there, and we'll look at his beauty and his amazing brilliance, but we won't be with him, literally. But let's look at verse 8 as well here. It says, when you said, seek my face, my heart said to you, your face, O Lord, I will seek. To seek, to stand before God. Now, that's not just a passive thing, but I'll come back to that thought. But more than any other form of government, democracy was based on people obeying the law. This nation's founded on what we call the rule of law. And we may take that for granted, but that, again, is unique in mankind's history. Because the law came from the people, a collective desire to have a unified approach to things, not to be ruled over. But every government has its weaknesses, doesn't it? Human government. And the weakness of a democracy is that eventually, when the masses figure out they can vote themselves the benefit, then it becomes a grab, doesn't it? I don't really care what happens to everybody else as long as I get mine. But that rule of law and democracy was an interesting thing because initially, that obedience to the law was not from compulsion. See, kings can do that. Dictators can do that. They can tell you, do what I say or else. But America was founded on a different principle. That rule of law was obeyed because they knew that they were accountable to God. And there are many, even to this day, that will argue that this nation was not founded on religious principles. And it most certainly was. Not everybody attended church. They all saw the hand of God in some form or another. And they realized that what was missing in previous expressions of human government was that deference to God. And so you can even see that in the Declaration of Independence. But for that law, which should be based on truth, to have any value, it has to be sought out and then acted upon, doesn't it? Let's go back to Matthew, this time in chapter 7. Let's shift the perspective a little bit here. Christ said that his way involved a narrow path. And in Matthew 7 and verse 13, it says, enter by the narrow gate, for wide is the gate and broad is the way that leads to destruction. And there are many who go in by it. Verse 14, because narrow is the gate, and difficult is the way which leads to life, and there are few who find it. That farmer searching for wealth was not unique. Most people don't take advantage of the opportunities in front of them. And there can be talk at times even in terms of what would be equitable. We search for equity in the world around us. But we seek for that to be the same for you as the same for me. That's not necessarily equitable. Equitable should be based on fairness. What is fair for you should be fair for me, because not everybody's going to be of the same ability. Going back to the parable of the talents, why did that Lord give one 5, one 2, and another man 1? Was that equitable? Based on the parable, it was. He said he gave each according to their ability. But there's an element of truth in there, isn't there? There are other parables that come into play here. The workers in the vineyard, was it fair? The ones that started, let's just use our clock system, was it fair that those that started at 9 o'clock and worked till 5 got paid the same as those that started at 4 and worked till 5? They didn't think so. They said, look, this is what you agreed to. But it's not about payment, is it? It's about what's received. We're not owed anything. for obeying God's way of life, but it's what he is offering. And in that parable, what's the lesson? At the end of the day, salvation is salvation. Doesn't matter if you are part of God's church, his way of life, your whole life, or if you were only a member of his body for 10 years. There's some who see a difference, but in God's eyes, there is no difference because salvation is salvation. There are no degrees of salvation. You have more salvation than I do. You either are saved or you're not. And so this path, this narrow way here in Matthew 7, 13, and 14, this narrow path is not the path of the status quo of the world, is it? Because narrow is difficult. Narrow is challenging. Narrow you have to pay attention to. You know, in having family in this weekend, on Thursday, I spent the day driving. In order to have a couple of people here that we wanted to have here, I went down to Cincinnati, drove down to Cincinnati, left very early in the morning, picked up two people, and then did the same thing in reverse. Okay? I forgot how narrow some of the roads are in Ohio. I've been away long enough now that I forget. And I was making my way to my dad's house, doing some of the back roads, not highways, because it was shorter that way. They have no shoulders on the sides of the roads on some of these areas. You have to pay a lot more attention. You can't drift and hit the rumble strip. Oh, yeah, I've got to move back over. You drift, there's no rumble strip. You're out in the culvert. The narrow is harder, isn't it? What's the narrow way? When we talk about human behavior, when we talk about what God is offering, we're talking about the talents, we're talking about the sower, the field, we're talking about the vineyards and the workers. It's understanding that we don't have all the answers, but that we try in what is being asked of us. A wise man once said that admitting wrong is the hardest thing a person could do. But to succeed by the world's standards oftentimes involves deep compromise with God's laws, with matters of right and wrong, with truth versus error, and more things. Some of you have faced similar challenges that I had in the career that I had before I became a pastor. I was oftentimes up against the Sabbath or the holy days, just the nature of the business that I was in. And I had one lady say to me one time, she was a vice president of a division of a retail company I was working for, and she could not understand why I would not work Saturday. It was really a token thing. She said, well, trying to justify, she said, well, you're not really going to do much work. She said, we all come in because the president does, and he expects us all to be here. So for her, it was just reasonable. It's just coming in, filling time, half day, and then you go home. And when I said, well, that may be, but I'm not going to be here, she realized, and she used a term. I even grinned when she said it. I don't know what she thought of that grin, but she said, so this is non-negotiable. And I said, yeah, it's non-negotiable. I lost that job, but it wasn't a great loss. But that's a narrow way, isn't it? How many people stand up for right principles regarding anything? Look at the current conversation about various police departments around the nation, and the bad examples that pop up, and how oftentimes they're not addressed. It's pushed aside, it's covered up, or whatever happens to be. With God's law, that's not the case, isn't it? We're to do. When you read many of the parables that Christ talked about, there's action involved, isn't there? We have a responsibility to participate. The principles, the thoughts, the attitudes, it requires standing up against the world and saying, I will not compromise what is right. Those times are tough, aren't they? Because they're unsure. What will God do? Promises to take care of us, promises to provide for us. He knows what's happening, he says, in our lives, and he cares for us. But there's still the unknown, isn't there? The boss then calls you in and says, okay, well, they can't say that they're going to fire you over the Sabbath, so they fire you over something else. You're not living up to our expectations, so we're going to have to let you go. Well, What do I do to pay the bills next week? It's an uncertainty, isn't it? The world's viewpoint is that those that stand up for principles, they tend to beat down, don't they? Because those individuals make others look bad because they don't try as hard. But the success of the world is fleeting, isn't it? That retail company that I worked for doesn't exist anymore. It didn't exist about 8 or 10 years after I left that company. Who remembers the second or third place winners of last year's Summer Olympic Games in any division? Any division. Some will, but not many. Who was the number one businessman of 20 years ago? Anybody remember that? Who was the number one entertainer or actor or director of 10 years ago? Life moves on, doesn't it? People forget. They forget the accomplishments of just a couple of years ago. But God's way of life and the character we develop is going to endure for eternity, never to be forgotten. Is that of value to us? Is it worth the narrow way? Is it worth the seed being nourished, cultivated, developed, so it will grow? We may not get the fame, the money, the recognition, or the position the world currently seeks, but we'll have something more important, won't we? Let's go to Luke chapter 12. One thing the world lacks, and that I pray that those of us in God's church can counter properly, is that the world does not have a vision of sacrificing for the future. Especially in this country. We're a very now people, aren't we? I don't want to wait for anything. So we have drive up everything, it seems. And we have credit cards because we don't want to save money up. Let's just spend. Let's just go out and buy. Luke 12 and verse 32. Do not fear, little flock, for it is your Father's good will to give you the kingdom. It's not something we have to earn. It's not something we have to go out and demand under certain circumstances. This is what God wants to give us. How valuable is that? We can only answer that individually because it involves us committing and sacrificing, doesn't it? There are other people, there are thousands of other people that understand what you and I understand or have at one point and have chosen not to follow through on that. It's too hard. The phrase I've heard too many times is that it's such a burden. Is it a burden to invest in a future that's going to be something beyond our wildest imaginations? Your Father's goodwill, our life, our calling now is to make the choice between accepting the compromises of this world or committing to God's truth, no matter what others do. That puts us outside the norm, doesn't it? It makes us stand out. One of the things I remember when I was at Ambassador College in Big Sandy back in the early 80s, East Texas at that time was less populated than it was now. The college really stood out because it was in Big Sandy. There's nothing else in Big Sandy. You have to go to Tyler. Even Longview's not as big. If you want a big city, you have to go 2 or plus hours west to Dallas. And so we were it, and the whole town knew who we were. And so some, you know, Saturday nights, they wanted to go out dancing. They'd go to whatever local places would do that. And the students thought they blended in. They never blended in. Because they didn't act the same. They didn't talk the same. They didn't do the same things, even though they thought they just were there like everybody else. We stand out just by nature of doing what God is asking us to do. And while we may lose things temporarily, I'd have to go back and count it up. I've lost I don't know how many jobs over the Sabbath, the holy days. And while there was uncertainty in those moments, at that time, I don't regret doing it, because in every circumstances, God provided something better. We may lose family temporarily. Christ even said that. You're going to be hated for my name's sake. Even family. We may face hardship and persecution at times. We may struggle at times in overcoming our human nature. But we must go through all of these things if we're truly seeking that pearl of great price. Let's look at that parable in Matthew 13. This is another example that goes back to the example in the introduction I gave you. You know, instead of diamonds, it's a pearl of great price. So Matthew 13, we're not going to read the whole parable here, but it simply says in verse 46, who when he has found one pearl of great price, this individual, went and sold all that he had and bought it. Okay, let's put this in a modern context. You don't have much money, but you've got $100. And somebody tells you, take that $100 and invest it in this company. Tomorrow they're going to do an IPO, put the whole $100 in that, because I can guarantee you in 3 weeks it's going to be worth $10,000. Would you do it? God is telling us to invest everything we have in His way of life. It's a pearl of great price. More than we could ever buy. But we have to make the investment. How precious is the truth of God to us? To go back to something I mentioned earlier, we know the answers to the great questions of life. And again, people don't ponder these things in these ways, but they do in what they pursue in life. We know who and what God is. And He's nothing like is promoted in the world, in the world's churches, or those that even reject that there is a God. We know why we, mankind, but even we individually, exist and what happens after our physical death. We know the purpose of life. If you had to buy that understanding, would you pay for it? Our reason for being is the truth. I remember someone saying that once, and I wrote it down because I found it so profound. Our reason for being is the truth. Everything else is simply filling in the details. Do we seek to know God's truth? Do we seek to do it? I've known people, especially over the course of my pastoral ministry, who know a great deal of truth, but they can't pull the trigger on it. They're afraid of losing that job. They're afraid of losing the family. They're afraid of being on the outside instead of on the inside. They're afraid, and so they won't commit. And what usually happens, more often than not, is that what they do know begins to fade very quickly until they don't know any of it. Let's go to Psalm 33 and consider that what we're about, what we're called to become is like God, isn't it? We read the verse earlier that it is His desire, it is His goodwill to give us the kingdom. But if someone is going to give you something, they have the right to say, first of all, what that something is, right? And if there are any conditions. I'm giving you this gift, but I want you to use it this way. Is that wrong? No, it's their gift. Psalm 33 and verse 4. God does a very similar thing with us. He's offering us eternal life. He's offering us a place in His family, in His kingdom, for the rest of eternity. But He says it has to be done a certain way. Many people find that offensive. I don't. It's His. No more offensive than someone coming to my house and saying, please take your shoes off when you come in. Psalm 33 and verse 4. The Spirit of God has made me. I'm sorry, I'm looking in the wrong place. Let me get to the right place. Although that's a good verse. Psalm 33, verse 4. The word of the Eternal is right, and all of His work, all of it, is done in truth. Again, do we believe this? God, there is no variation, there is no error, there is no inconsistency in what God does. The interesting thing about truth is that it is either truth or it is not. we use an expression that is not accurate when someone's playing fast and loose with truth. We call it white lies, or we call it half-truths. No, it's either true or it's not true. If I put poison in some water, is it partially poisonous? Or is it poisonous? Everything God does is in truth. Truth is never changing. It's always the same. Humanly, we can get bored with sameness, can't we? But God never changes, and we should be deeply appreciative of that, because what if he did? What if tomorrow he said, you know what, I've changed my mind. I'm done with this. Fed up with mankind, I'm just going to let it spin out of control, and then I'll just wipe it clean. We wouldn't have any future, would we? The interesting thing about truth is that no matter how far back in time you go or how far forward in time you go, it's the same, isn't it? Humanly, we can create and do marvelous things. Look at the change that has taken place in the last 100 or so years. The world is completely different, isn't it? But that's knowledge. It's not truth. Truth never changes. Because God himself is truth. Psalm 117. Psalm 117 in verse 2. For his merciful kindness is great towards us, and the truth of the eternal endures forever. This is a question only you can ask, but have you ever invested time in something only to find out down the road that something's changed and that you can't do anything with it anymore? You know, maybe the instructor was unclear and he gave an assignment. You think, okay, I can do that. So you invest however many hours into doing this. You show up at class, and as he starts talking, you realize you focused on the wrong thing. Now that work doesn't really matter, does it? The interesting thing with God is that truth is there forever. It's not changing. Who and what God is? Well, let me just ask the question. Who and what is God? He's love and truth. God is love. And he is truth. It says right here that that truth endures forever. It will never change. The laws involving the principles that he wants us to follow exist in him. The spiritual laws have existed as long as God has existed. And this is the flaw of Christianity, that they claim what we call the Old Testament is done away with. Well, what part did God say is no longer part of me? Because if you do that, then what you're doing is slicing off pieces of God you don't like. We have to be careful we don't do that. Let's go to Psalm 119, 142. Psalm 119, verse 142. Your righteousness is an everlasting righteousness, and your law is truth. The Ten Commandments, what some call the Torah, the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Bible, that involves truth. It's instruction specifically, originally to Israel, the nation, for them to understand who and what God was and what he expected of them. What were the standards of righteousness? He gave them a lot of laws of morality. How this life would work best, relationship laws, national laws, all sorts of things, even down to the matter of what is food and what is not food. Is that truth or not truth? I've mentioned this before. I had an uncle back in the early 70s that had open heart surgery, and that was a new procedure back then. I think there was only one hospital in Cincinnati that did it at the time. He survived that, but one of the first things they told him post-surgery was, no pork, no shellfish. It's too problematic. They knew it. And yet, once he was healthy enough, he went back to pork and shellfish. It's a truth that mankind has walked away from. Let's go to John 17 again. I think we read that earlier. I want to read it again if we did. but just as a reminder of what Christ himself said to the Father. John 17:17, sanctify them by your truth. Your word is truth. So which part of this Bible is not truth? Which part of it is no longer something we have to follow? No longer something that should guide our attitudes, our actions? No longer the definition of who God is and what we should strive to become? We can say with confidence that the Bible reveals these essential truths. They're foundational truths, unavailable from any other source. Mankind has used some of them and codified some of them. But mankind as a whole doesn't go to this as the source of understanding and foundation of relationships. Well, let's go to Titus 1. There's an interesting verse here in connection with this thought about what is truth. And at times, I think we as human beings struggle with this concept and what God says he cannot do. Is there anything God cannot do? It's a bit of a trick question because we're going to answer it here in Titus 1 verse 2. It says here, breaking into the thought, Paul talking about his credentials, if you will, his relationship with God and the Father and Christ. He says, in hope of eternal life which God has, who cannot lie, and promised before time began. Back up in verse 1, he's talking about the acknowledgement of truth. That God cannot lie. That should instill great confidence in us, but sometimes, again, I think we can struggle with that because that's not our human experience, is it? Now, I'm going to ask a question tongue-in-cheek here. Have you ever been lied to? The better question is, have you ever not been lied to? It's just part of the human experience, isn't it? We're lied to all the time. But truth as a moral and personal characteristic of God is sure. Let's go to Exodus 34 because I want to elaborate on a characteristic here. Exodus 34 and verse 6. Says, and the Eternal passed before him. This is Moses. There, Moses is up on the mountain talking to God. God's giving him the instruction for the nation. It says, the Eternal passed before him and proclaimed, the eternal God, merciful and gracious, long-suffering and abounding in goodness and truth. Now, keep in mind where we just came from. Where did we just come from? Titus 1:2. What can God not do? Lie. This is God speaking. This is not Moses saying of God. This is God himself saying, I am merciful and gracious, long-suffering and abounding in goodness and truth. And it's either true or it's not. Because God can't lie. And if it's true, then that's amazing, isn't it? I'm reading from the New King James. In the King James Version, it uses the word abundant. That God is abundant in goodness and truth. That may sound odd. What does it mean to be abundant in truth? Well, look at it in terms of a comparison. Abundant versus scarce. Would you rather deal with someone abundant in truth or scarce in truth? Scarce in truth means you don't know when they're true. Isaiah 65, verse 16, we're told that God is the God of truth. Psalm 119, verse 151, we're told that all of God's commandments are truth. Why is it important to consider this? I mean, if you just did a word search on the word truth, you would found it used hundreds and hundreds of times. But we have a very interesting story that I want to begin wrapping up with here today, and that's in John 18. A question was asked of Christ. And again, in John's account, we're up to the time of Christ being examined before he was going to be scourged and crucified. And he's standing before Pilate. the Jews are trying to line things up to justify having Christ killed because they don't want to do it themselves, because they can't. They'd have to answer to the Roman authorities, and quite honestly, they simply didn't have a reason to. And so they're trying to orchestrate things so that somebody else will do this for them. And so they bring him to Pilate, ostensibly because he's preaching treason and he's not following their law. And Pilate, I find it very interesting, even earlier, Pilate says, I'm not a Jew, I don't care about your law. But John 18, verse 37, Pilate here asks a question. Are you a king then? This is one of the charges that the Pharisees were trying to make. You know, he's out teaching heresy, or excuse me, treason here, because he's claiming to be a king and he's going to rebel from Caesar. Never mind that he hasn't done anything to do that, but this is what they're saying. So Pilate simply asks the question, are you a king? Christ answers, and he said, you say rightly that I am a king. For this cause I was born. For this cause I've come into the world, that I should bear witness to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth hears my voice. And we know he was not proclaiming or coming to take that throne at that time. But he did come to become king, didn't he? So then I find it interesting in that exchange then, because Christ touches on the word truth twice. So Pilate's response is, what is truth? It's a good question, isn't it? Now, how was Pilate asking this question? Some say that he was sort of sneering as he says this, you know, dismissing it. What is truth? Nobody knows what truth is. I don't read it that way. I almost read this as a begging, that he sees a glimpse of something here in a man that he's not seen this in others. What is truth? Because truth is all we have to hang on, isn't it? I read this as a man, Pilate, as a man being tired of lies and half-truths. Because that was the world he was in, and that's the world that we're in. Who do we believe now? The news will rush something out, and it looks horrible. But a week later, as the news percolates around and other people get to the point of reporting other aspects of this thing, we find out what was originally reported isn't the truth of the matter. It's part of the truth, but it's not the whole story, or it's none of the story. So we're lied to. And I wouldn't be surprised. People start asking a similar question. What is truth? Because we're lied to by our elected leaders, even when they're caught in a lie. I didn't say that. What do you mean you didn't say that? I've got the audio right here. News outlets, I mentioned. Rush out the sensational. That's what attracts viewers. They're not interested in the truth. Our court systems are not interested in the truth. Religious leaders lie to their followers. Parents lie to their children. There is an Easter Bunny. There is a Santa Claus. That has consequences when you establish a lie. Even scientists held up as seekers of truth lie for money, for fame. But you and I have been given the truth. This is why Christ touched on this here. He says, I came to not only become king, but to bear witness of what is true. You and I are here because of what is true. Not what is convenient, not as what is popular, not what makes our life easy, but what is true. What is God offering? You and I know who and what God is and what he desires for mankind, what he's offering us individually. We know the reason again for life, the reason for our existence. We know and we have the truth, which is the hope of eternal life. What will we do with that truth? Truth has to be acted upon. Russell Cromwell told his story of the acres of diamonds as a metaphor of great wealth and opportunity that someone missed, even when it was right in front of them. As the people of God, we have been given a great truth. Let us make the most of that gift.